afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, February 2nd, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Last Saturday, a revolution was launched in New York City, which centered around the idea of the creation of a new cultural paradigm. Sponsored by the Schiller Institute and featuring a keynote by Helga Zepp LaRouche, the conference took up the challenge of our time. How do we affect the changes necessary to reverse the present course on our planet toward war and genocide? To do so, we must create a different culture, which rejects the present paradigm centered on money, dominated by sense perception, in which people are reduced to the status of beasts. And how do we create a beautiful culture? How do we take the present downtrodden population, pessimistic, fearful, and impotent, and give them a sense of the real beauty of man? That will be the topic of our program today. Let me just open by saying that there's not much to love in our present culture. It's not as though people can cling to this current paradigm and say, this is so wonderful. We're economically and financially bankrupt. We're trapped into barbaric battles, medieval-style religious warfare, which are taking the form of a clash of civilizations, rapidly moving to a World War III. And our society is dominated by the rock, sex, drug culture launched by the 68ers, an ugly culture which emphasizes sensual pleasure rather than creativity and critical thinking. When I first joined the LaRouche movement about 40 years ago, Lyndon LaRouche emphasized at that time that the rock, sex, drug counterculture was launched by those oligarchs in power to weaken the minds of the population so they would be unable to react against the genocidal policies that were being introduced by those same oligarchs. It is that counterculture which is now the dominant culture. And so we can see today exactly how prescient Lyndon LaRouche was back in the late 60s. And now at this late moment, we have to make a change. Joining me on the program today to discuss this are two people who participated in last Saturday's Schiller Institute conference in New York City. We have Michael Steger, who is a member of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee. He's calling in from San Francisco. And his wife, Mihua Steger, who is working on creating a national music program to bring about a return to classical culture. So Michael and Mihua, welcome to the program.
Thanks,
Harley.
I'd like to begin by getting at this question of the overall climate in which we are launching this project. The conference had discussions about the crisis in the Near East, the financial crisis. Mrs. LaRouche's keynote, which is available on the LaRouche PAC website, was very clear on this. It was a fairly big audience. Mihua, why don't you start and just give us a little bit of a picture of your sense of how the conference went.
I think considering the context of the strategic situation where we find ourselves very close to a hyperinflationary blowout, and it's not just centered in the United States, it's around the world, it's international. And, you know, the conference was coming at a time that also you've got an intersection of a war danger. So the idea from Helga was specifically to intervene on this process, to give the population a sense of where we can move, what direction humanity can go, because this is obviously not the direction we intend to go in terms of hyperinflation and war. So I think the organizing that was done throughout the New Jersey area and with our institutional contacts, our intelligence contacts, really drew a crowd that can't be separated from the fact that people are looking for a solution. They're looking for, you know, they're not getting it from, obviously the election didn't help. There was no discussion in the election around solutions. And it's our organization that has presented the three-point program on Glass-Steagall, the national banking system, and NAWAPA, but as a package, not as something that you take in and of itself. And of course, what we had to address fundamentally was the how the population is thinking. Because that's the crucial point. If we're going to change the direction that mankind is moving, then we have to change the way that people think. It's not what you think doesn't really matter. It's how you think. And our concept of money and our concept of culture today is very degraded. So the people that came were extremely moved by the cultural intervention. Because not only, I mean, you had 60-plus people up there on stage working through the Bach Magnificat. And to guests who didn't know who all of us were, when they found out that we're full-time political organizers in this organization, that even created a much more profound sense of what they were involved in. And I think that's
I want to come back to this question of the cultural presentations at the conference in a moment. But just to complete the thought, Michael, I'd like to know what your sense coming out of the conference was, because we had some developments going in with a court ruling to throw out at least one aspect of the Obama dictatorship. We see Glass-Steagall as a fighting issue throughout the transatlantic region, but we still see this insane commitment to the war, which is typified by Obama's support for the Anglo-Saudi Al-Qaeda terrorist forces. So given all that, what did you see, Michael, coming out of the conference?
Well, I think you generally see an excitement towards the sense of victory. And I think that really distinguishes the two different kinds of the population today. Is one, many people now see the crisis. The question is how many people are dedicated to a sense of victory. And even the speakers that attended the conference, you could see a transformation of them just from one panel to the next, that they were getting more excited. They had a sense of participating in something somewhat radical in nature, a total shift in the world economic system, but also just a sense of inspiration that what they were participating in was something profound. So I think now you take the context of the D.C. Appellate Court case, you take the fight for Glass-Steagall International, you take Richard Fisher's statement from the Dallas Fed, you now have a growing momentum not only to address the severe problems and to address the push for tyranny, the push for dictatorship, the push for genocide, but you're now developing something that can replace those, that can fill the vacuum. And I think that's why these conferences will be continued.
Now, as Michal was saying, the cultural side of this, I mean, given that it is the Schiller Institute and that Helga Zeppler-Rusch is known for her interventions on this question of putting the issue of the beauty of man, the natural condition of mankind, not being to be degenerate. Why don't you give us a sense of what the program was of music and how that worked, Michal?
Well, we had a combination of our New Jersey, Boston regions that collaborated together moving into this conference on Bach's Magnificat, like I was discussing earlier. And, you know, we had a small orchestra, we had a full chorus, and I think that the intent and what people in the audience gained from this was, it's just something that, it's a domain of the imagination that exists. And that's, if people are going to become optimistic about a potential shift in the future, one that they're going to generate, then we have to create a capability for them to participate in this domain. And it's not separate. It's the politics, the science, and the music. What the sense that people got that participated in this conference is that it is a unique whole. And it's not something you can really explain, but it's something that we're somewhat built with, is an instinct for the good and an instinct for unity. And I think it was... the performance in and of itself was very inspiring for people.
Oh, and it's not the typical kind of thing that you go to a conference and have a performance of a piece such as the Magnificat by Bach. And also, I understand you perform one of the Beethoven cello piano sonatas.
We had an evening session that was, there were three panels, and the Magnificat was presented before the second panel. And there was an evening panel that was actually in a smaller cathedral setting. It was more intimate, and it was the panel that was dedicated to a discussion around what had occurred throughout the day. And we started it with Beethoven's Opus 102, number 1. And that's a cello piano sonata. And I think that it created a capability for people to discuss where we can go from here.
Well, I like the way you said that it's not the kind of thing you can talk about, because it really isn't. But in fact, you've been tasked with that responsibility of trying to develop a language to discuss what happens in music that actually moves us. Maybe you can say a little bit about that.
Well, I can refer people to the weekly report from this past Wednesday, and that's the beginning of a working hypothesis and a rigorous approach to what this means, because it is an existential question for mankind. And through the discussions we've been having over the last week or so, what is the role of the audience in participation of music such as this? And actually, Lynn brought it up today. He said that the participation is the expression of humanity. It's not the individual assertion, because there is a right and a wrong in society. That's something we do know. Now, we're actually having to create a standard by which people have to meet. We're raising the standards. We're increasing the responsibility on each individual to generate the shift, not to sit back and wait for something to happen. There's a lot of people that out, you know, that want us to. They're going to wait until we get Obama out before they support us, and that doesn't make any sense, because it's from the standpoint of a consumer, which you can understand because we live in a consumer society.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Michael, you've been working with the policy committee in the recent months to accomplish precisely that, to get people from being spectators into being participants. And yet there's an irony here, because in classical cultural presentations, the audience is not participating. It's not kind of a group think kind of thing. You're actually trying to do something different. How do you put together in your mind this idea of bringing in the cultural questions into political organizing?
But, you know, we've had some discussions here recently on that idea. I want to say a couple of things. One is that the second panel was ended by a Chinese opera singer. She's someone who had been brought in to a project by a woman by the name of Lin Yan, and she also Lin presents in the third panel in the evening, the more intimate one that Mihua referenced. So the opera singer, at the end of the second panel, kind of gave a sense of what classical culture had done to her, for her as an individual. That it was something that had given her a quality of human identity that she now is self-consciously able to reflect upon, that transformed her existence and life. And in the project that Lin and her and other artists, particularly Chinese in this case, but it's now branching out to others, is to demonstrate that if we don't revive a classical culture today, we are losing the mind and the creative potential of an entire generation. What they've done is taken inner city New York children, somewhat underprivileged or in difficult circumstances, and demonstrated to the so-called liberal elites, or the elites of the city and of the cultural, you know, nature of our society today, that not only do young people get inspired by classical music and are engaged in it almost in an intrinsic and natural way, but even the most challenging and difficult pieces, the most advanced pieces by Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart, are the ones that are the most compelling. It's not an introductory level kind of process. The people are actually engaged by the most advanced development that musical composition has taken. One thing that was we were reflecting on recently is in the early parts of our development of this generation of the LaRouche movement, because Niho and I joined, you know, 10 years ago, and we used to have an advanced development to really challenge the generations around a sense of ideas, to get beyond sense perception, to get into a domain where ideas were the most substantial characteristic of human society, which you now see almost clearly in this kind of political fight, where all the practical sense-perceived characteristics are insignificant. And it's really the question of what ideas do you have to solve the problem? From where do those ideas come from? What domain? What outlook in history? And we used to run this experiment, Niko and I did, where we used to do an evening session of intense mathematics, looking at one of Carl Gauss's papers that shows that really the world is not mathematical. It's a world of ideas, but it's a mathematical paper. So it had an intrinsic irony. We'd go through a 2 or 3 hour session. In the beginning of it, Niho would play a French suite, a Bach French suite. And people would be shuffling through papers, they'd be whispering, talking. I don't know if people texted 10 years ago, but things of that nature. And so she played through the piece. And then after a 2 or 3 hour session of concentrated work, a collaborative effort, discussions, at the end of the session in the evening, around 11 o'clock or 11:30, Niho would play the Bach suite again. And people were totally transformed. The concentration level, the sense of, and it wasn't, now I say in the first playing of the piece, people were just an audience watching. In the second performance, they were an engaged part of the performance. The idea now was everyone was participating in a generation, kind of the pianist Andras Schiff reference, almost like a religious community celebrating a single idea. And Bach is kind of unique in that way. I think that that's really where the classical culture is. It takes people out of just purely spectators, because it's not entertainment, and a participation of the celebration of an idea and of ideas in general. So I think that's crucial right now for the political process.
Yeah, that's very important. I'm in the middle of writing a review of a very good performance I saw of Don Giovanni in Houston last week. And I'm thinking about this question of what Lynn is talking about. We've got to reach the 5%. We've got to reach the thinkers, the insiders, and give them this sense of politics from the top. But to ultimately succeed, you have to change the population outside of that. And I was thinking about how Mozart, from The Marriage of Figaro and then Don Giovanni and then The Magic Flute, was undertaking that kind of process of thinking about how you move an audience with an idea, with a musical idea. And you know, I think this is partly the kind of challenge that we have. We have the benefit of having the works of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and others, but we don't yet have Mozarts among us. So how, I know this is part of what was discussed, Niko, the last couple of days in your discussions in Virginia, on how to demonstrate these principles of transformation in music. I wonder if you could just give us a little hint beyond what you did in the weekly report.
A hint beyond that. Well, I can't give away what we're going to do on Wednesday. but the
build the audience for it.
We can do that. We have the direction the discussion has been going over the past few days is the relationship. Lynn's been bringing it up more emphatically. The class, it's not just classical music, it's classical drama, it's classical poetry. So then, what is this idea of classical? And if you think about it from drama or music, the domain of the imagination is what exists. It's not, you are actually transported from where you're currently sitting into a completely different quality of space and out of real time, but brought into a certain timeless quality. But that can only exist in your mind. That can only exist in mind. So we have a very unique faculty that was God-given, and we're the only ones, and just bringing it back to the question of the strategic situation, we're the only ones that have the capability of changing this. And so in terms of the music work, Bach is fundamental because he's, in his discovery of the well tempering through the preludes and fugues, what you see is a rigorous study, very dense studies of how your mind wants to work, how your mind wants to work at the highest level. And it's essentially a metaphor. They're all conceptual metaphors that are accessible because they are so dense. And I think that we can really use these to re-educate a population and educate them out of their pessimism, their cynicism about how, nothing's going to change. It's always going to be the same. History repeats itself. But nobody that really steeps themselves in daily work-throughs of Bach say that.
Well, you also have the idea that's out there that the playing classical music is old-fashioned, it's tired. There was a review of the Don Giovanni which said that it's tired. Now, there's a Don Giovanni that was performed in Berlin where he was a predatory lesbian. And that was a way of trying to modernize and update it, but it missed the whole point that Mozart was making, which is that it's not just that the evil existed in the aristocratic figure of Don Giovanni, but the evil existed as well in the passivity of the population, which tolerated that. So that you needed to have an intervention from natural law in the form of the statue coming to life to bring Don Giovanni to hell. So, you can see in some particular great pieces, you can see this process. But what you're talking about is different. You're talking about something that's accessible to everyone, not just the 5%. And I think that's really what we have to get at. And I have a question for you, Michael, in just a second. I just want to remind our listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. It's February 2nd, 2013, and we're talking with Michael and Michwa Steger about the cultural paradigm shift, which we are starting, which is already underway. And let me tell you, you can go to the LaRouchePack.com website to watch some of the videos are now posted from the conference in New York last week, and there are going to be a series of follow-up conferences. Michael, what can you tell us about what we decided to do as a follow-up to this last Saturday's conference?
Yeah, quite a lot. One thing in reflection upon what this conference represented was, Helga is herself a scholar of Nicholas of Cusa, and I was reminded of what really set the stage for the great golden renaissance of Florence, which was this Council of Florence in 1439, I think, is when it had its final kind of edict or kind of resolution, which was setting the stage for a fundamental shift in the institutions of Europe at that time around what is the conception of man. Out of these dark ages, these religious wars and the kind of economic doldrums of just repetitive, archaic, manual labor. So you see that these conferences and the ones that were held in Germany prior, and now this one in New York, and are similar of that nature. You're bringing in institutional people from around the world to discuss not individual predicated areas, but that we have to have a fundamental shift in the nature of man within all aspects of society today. And that what Lyndon LaRouche has done in that light is a major contribution to what the nature of man is now and how that is understood. So in the wake of that, clearly we should have more conferences. So we're going to have one. This is the 30th anniversary of the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative that Ronald Reagan launched in March 23rd of 1983. That really changed the course of history. It forced the issue of the failure of the Cold War paradigm, that mankind should advance, we should set up a defense system against nuclear war, and we should eliminate that threat. And a leading physicist involved in that, Dr. Edward Teller, had proposed that really the most advanced benefit of this satellite laser defense system, which was a complete breakthrough, would require a complete breakthrough in technology, would really be the asteroid defense aspects of it, that once we eliminated the threat of nuclear weapons, really the new threat that we face as a species on this planet would be an asteroid collision that could either eliminate a city or potentially even the entire species. And that this same defense system against nuclear weapons could be deployed against these near-Earth objects. So we've revived this asteroid defense system, and so on the 30th anniversary of the SDI, we're going to hold a major seminar in Washington to celebrate the cultural questions, the questions of an absolute necessity of a new renaissance, and this question of the human species acting concertedly to eliminate the asteroid threats and push mankind further into an exploration of our universe. This will include advanced scientific groups. We've got, you know, a lot of these staffers in Washington on the science committees. These people have been already introduced to these conceptions that we're engaging them in, and they should come. We've talked to leading military sectors. I personally have talked to the staff of the general for in the United States Air Force, who's involved in our nuclear arsenal, and they were incredibly excited about these questions. So we're expecting that kind of attendance in very institutional presence, and to revive not just that this is a U.S. policy, but this should be a U.S., Russia, China, and human policy of international collaboration. So that's exciting. That should be in March at some time in Washington. And then we intend to do something in May around in San Francisco, around the Pacific orientation. This Russia, China, you've got, you know, Korea, Japan, so much potential in Asia, the NAWAPA developments, the Bering Strait implications, and just a great potential a true continental United States has for a relationship with so much of the world for development. And so these are very exciting things on the short-term horizon.
And it's to go back to the Council of Florence, what's interesting if you look at the initial Renaissance that grew out of that is that you had, among other things, Platonists from Istanbul, or Constantinople, I should say, who were invited to come to the council and stayed, and under the influence of the Medicis, set up a Platonic Academy. And this spread eventually, the influence of Cusa and the work of the conference spread into France with the establishment of Louis XI and his government, England and Henry VII, who brought in Platonists to set up a Platonic Academy at Oxford. And of course, as always happens, there was a counter movement that came primarily at that time from Venice. And, you know, in music, Nephi, I know you've done a lot of work on this. I just wanted to mention the fact that this year is the year of Verdi. It's the 200th anniversary, but it's also the 200th anniversary of Wagner. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is consistently deployments against the classical style, the classical method, by people, whether it's Franz Liszt or Wagner. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's going to be part of what we have to do to show the difference between real classical music based on a method of thinking versus the idea of an epical moment or a time period.
Well, I think it's necessary to emphasize the question of the future. And this is why Bach was initiated taking on Bach's compositions was initiated because of this. I mean, you've got a culture now that is heavily steeped in me now. I want this now. I want this. I want to see this happen now. And it's immediate gratification. And you have a complete lack of a sense of the future. And I think this addresses the difference between the imagination, or the domain of the imagination, and the domain of fantasy. Because fantasy is generally immediate, and there's nothing really truly realistic about it. It's nothing that you would want to actualize. That's what I'm assuming in terms of how most people think today. But the question of the future orientation, and this would give people access to that, especially through Bach. And what we brought up on Wednesday is the tension that of the reality of the situation that pulls you forward, just like what JFK used to initiate his space program, or the program for the moon. And that was something when we didn't have the capabilities readily available, we didn't know how we were going to get there, but there was a drive forward, particularly because there was a mission orientation. And Lynn's been bringing up this, you know, because our population has been culturally damaged, in a sense, that we have to fight to get this idea of the future back, that it's what you generate or fight to actualize what's actually occurring in your imagination for the future.
I like the way you put it on the weekly report, where I think you said the future is not something that happens to you, but something which you can create.
Yeah.
Well, how does that manifest itself in music?
How does, what, the future?
The future orientation, that Bach was not just writing for the sake of his supper, but that he was actually writing something to instruct and to challenge the imagination of people who would come after him.
Well, I think that if you put yourself in the position of, if you've been lucky enough to witness Bach performed correctly, then the question of the future becomes realistic, because what I did say on Wednesday is that what do you usually do when you're optimistic? You contemplate the future. You try to figure out what your next step is, where you can go from here. And you're not sitting there dwelling on the past or, you know, wishing it life was like it was 15 years ago. But I think that it's something we're struggling to communicate to people, because I think it creates the conditions for a solution to really occur. And in terms of the music, it's a difficult, I know we've been communicating it, but it's still a difficult subject to discuss, especially when you don't have the domain of demonstration.
Yeah, sure.
Because that's the key for people within their mind. Because if you remember, it was the first two measures of Bach's fugue from Book 2, the D minor fugue.
Mm-hmm.
Just within those two measures, you can demonstrate a qualitative difference when you introduce the element of mind. And that's something that's universal. That's something that exists among all of us. We all have, and we're given, a mind to use. And with that, it just creates a responsibility on each person, like I said before, not to just consume goodness, but to create it, to generate it. Because for somebody like Bach, I mean, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, what was their mission? They didn't have what you would consider easy lives. They didn't have a life full of paradise. But it was paradise in a sense because of where they lived in their mind. Beethoven is a perfect example of this. If you look at his Heiligenstadt Testament, somebody that was driven to the point of emotional, it was an emotional tension where you would actually contemplate suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, he had to realize, and I think he did realize, that what he represented was much more than himself. And I think that's the challenge that we're putting out to the people that we're meeting on the streets, to the institutional figures we're talking to.
Sure, that's how you overcome the littleness. The sense that there's nothing you can do. When you take a case of someone like Beethoven, the Heiligenstadt Testament is one of the most beautiful examples, because he raises this question that since he's losing his hearing, how can he, who is supposed to be most proficient in hearing, admit that he can't hear?
Mm-hmm.
And yet he concludes that he was given this gift and this capability. And I think it was realized in much later in life when he was writing the late quartets, and one of the people trying to rehearse them with him there stopped and just said, "I don't understand this." And Beethoven said, "It's not for you, it's for the future. Keep playing." And I think it's that idea of confidence that we can come up with solutions, but the solutions require a different quality of thinking. And that is the organizing process. And Michael, I know that you've been very much involved with the policy committee to make sure that we have in the younger generation in our organization the kind of change in precisely that to move from this idea that we're just trying to recruit people to a program or we just want to win an election, to actually create a changed circumstance in the country based on creativity.
Yeah, the recent visit to Washington, D.C. by a number of the people who had run the congressional campaigns, I mean, Keisha Rogers in Texas, you know, huge impact in winning the Democratic primary with Obama's impeachment. What we did with Dave Christie in Seattle, Washington, and the state of Washington within the Democratic Party on Glass-Steagall was transformative. I mean, we've got a whole network of people now fighting for what it's not a banking regulation, but which is a change in the economic system. What Diane did in Jersey or Rachel in Boston, Bill Roberts had 41% in a Democratic primary, explicitly calling for Obama's removal. And what this did in Washington was set a standard. When our candidates and our policy committee are going into Washington, they're now seen in essence as an institution. The people who have the courage and the bravery to say, well, is now becoming more and more obvious to more and more people. We're facing dictatorship, a threat of world war, a total economic breakdown, and that we need a fundamental shift like Glass-Steagall and what's implied with Glass-Steagall, an absolute, you know, a change in the credit system, to refinance the system, and a real development project, a reason why we're doing these things, not just addressing the problems, but generating a new future. And you really see that kind of thinking, people are craving. And, you know, I think what Michal is saying on the box is just so amazing, that we have a language that can give people a demonstration, an example of that. That, to me, is incredibly unique. You know, Furtwängler said people want to create a sense of verbal description of Beethoven's compositions. And he's provoked by that because he doesn't think there is any verbal explanation for the composition, but that it's Beethoven's ability to compose with such clarity for the human mind that people think it has a verbal representation because it has so much meaning and clarity to them. And it's just remarkable that we have that and we just have to continue to apply it. It does demonstrate what the new nature of mankind should be in this paradigm if we can create it.
Well, this is the same point Lynn is making about science, which is that in order to make a breakthrough in science, you have to give up all the language and formulas that you had previously that characterized your sense of knowledge. And if you look at someone like Einstein or Max Planck, who were both dedicated musicians, they thought about things that were completely outside of the realm of the existing language. And, you know, I've been really fascinated by this relationship of science and music. And I know, Michal, you came to the organization as a musician. You hadn't done a whole lot of work at all in this. And yet you've developed a capability to discuss these things. I'd like you to just discuss that a little bit because, you know, your world that previously had been music, it had been in the conservatory, and yet you're continuing to make breakthroughs in music at the same time you can speak on these questions of science and politics. So, you know, maybe you can encourage people out there who think it's impossible to do these things.
Yeah. We are currently recruiting all musicians to basically give what their craft is real meaning for humanity, because it's not just developing one's craft. I remember 10 years ago just having come from music school and already having become entirely disappointed with the direction it was moving as you go higher, like, you know, graduate school, auditions for those types of institutions, it just becomes more and more detached. Well, it did become more and more detached from reality, from what we, coming in as freshmen, were truly happy about, which was really creating music. And I think as it goes along, you know, you have a stifling of the creative capability, and you see it everywhere. You see it in just the general education of people in science and in history. is that you're trying to get people on a mass scale to conform to certain opinions. And this is the work of, you know, an empire that's looking to create a bunch of slaves, so that's looking to create a bunch of people that kind of are, that don't think. And that's if you have, I mean, that's slavery.
I mean, that's something. The empire has been pretty successful at that. That's why we're in this.
That's why we're just looking for the 5%. There are a few that are eccentric, that exist outside of that. So just going back to 10 years ago, being confronted with Lynn's method of thinking that introduced me to a sense of universality and a real sense of purpose. Because I realized that it's much more profound to take on a responsibility for mankind rather than just thinking about yourself, what you're going to do in your life. But generating a society in which other people can participate. And the role of classical music is directly related to that. You're in terms of Furtwängler, we're fighting to create a genuine community of people that are participating on this level of ideas, not people. I mean, if you can imagine, if we had educational systems that educated people from a young age in this classical culture, that person going to a concert or a symphony concert or a more intimate setting, their participation is qualitatively different. And that's what we're fighting to create. And, you know, the shift was, over the last 10 years, has just been reinforced every single year, but especially over the last 2 years, in seeing our intervention, the impact of our interventions over the years, from the Social Security fight to winning that, to what we've been able to do with Obama. I mean, Lynn's idea of forecasting on Obama as Hitler and Obama as Nero was phenomenal, because what you see, that's the idea of the future. His forecast of Obama as Nero was genius, because we've seen it actualized, or we've seen the proof over the last few years with the National Defense Authorization Act, the drone assassination, all of these things. But Lynn's forecast was unique, and that's, we have to create more thinkers such as this.
I think also to bring that up is important, because that's the same issue with the FBI, that Lynn's conception,
right,
around the Strategic Defense Initiative as a shared capability between the U.S. and Russia, and winning Ronald Reagan over to that perspective, and then trying to organize that. And when it was rejected by the British agents in the Kremlin, first Andropov and then Gorbachev, Lynn said, look, within 5 years, the Soviet Union is going to collapse, because it's not looking to the future in science and technology. And as he himself admits, it was really closer to 6 years in reality. But nobody in 1983 was forecasting the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so, again, it's the same basic principle. And I guess, Michael, that's going to be a key point in what we do on this Washington, D.C. event on March 23rd.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I think what we're finding is there's also been a shift that maybe the culture and the caliber of the people participating then, the World War II veterans, was a different kind of generation than what we have in leadership today. I think that the recognition of a transformation in how we're thinking about the entire process is now different. It's also clear that the crisis matches that the risks now, though there was a risk of thermonuclear extinction, you know, from the 1960s onward through the 1980s and the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, we're talking now about a kind of extinction process. Even if we don't have a nuclear launch, we're still looking at a massive population reduction. Just because of a failure to act. And that's really what has to be addressed. I think that's why it's important that it is an SDI and SDE conference. You know, Max Planck really did take up these this problem that he saw happening, that there was a culture, even in science, intending to destroy the ability of an individual scientist who has an in-depth training, to be able to think into the future and to recognize that it's not simply a logical consistency or a participation in more collections of greater data in different areas, but that there's a quality to the human mind that I'm sure he experienced in music that he found crucial, and that it was going to be something, you know, outside what had occurred already. It would be, in a sense, a non-linear process, but that the human mind, and this is how I think he defines free will, which is that the ability to reflect upon the necessity of something completely different, and yet to have some ability for an imagination governed by a mission to identify what that would be. I think really it's the music which helps really set the tone for the mission of the human mind. We've got to bring this back so that the people who are going to participate in conferences like this can become conscious. How do we set an ability for mankind not only to solve the current crisis, but that we can sustain this kind of development? Because we have to. It's not just a question of solving it once. We have to solve this problem, develop this way of thinking, and now sustain it indefinitely, you know, hopefully for thousands of years into the future.
Well, and meanwhile, let me ask you a question that comes up a lot. So I've had the benefit of working with you for a lot of that 10 years and perform music with you and discuss these ideas. And I know you're, because not just because of your background, but because of who you are, these things are, I guess I could use the word second nature to you. You think in these terms. Most people don't. Most people have trouble sitting through classical music performance because they're so used to the sensual gratification of a beat or rubbing up against something. But how realistic is it to think that the ideas, the creative ideas that are the generating process for Bach can become something that's clear and accessible to the average person? What will we have to do to create that?
Well, we have to understand that it's absolutely necessary, and we start from that standpoint, that this is the foundation which true civilization was built on. And, I mean, to do good is an end in and of itself. It's just something it's an end and a means. So the main point is that I think that the context of the conferences that we're having across the country are creating a vehicle for us to be able to, around the country, to organize and recruit people to the fact that, because the impact that is created, even just for people that have no background, but able to participate in something as this, can be life-changing. That is something that there's an element within them that can shift the way that they normally think about cultures. It's not to say that they're going to become a completely different person and they're just going to be great and good and do that. But but if we have the intent to and have a foundation that this exists in every person, that every person has a capability to respond to beauty, but beauty from the standpoint of truth and not opinion, that's something that can be generated, and I think that these conferences are a vehicle for that, and it's going to be an intense process over the next few months, and I think we'll see the beginnings of a real shift very soon. We've already seen it in New York City. We've already seen the impact that was generated in New York City. The anniversary of the 30th anniversary of the SDI, I mean, these are a celebration, these conferences are a celebration of ideas and a celebration of what we're capable of as a species.
And I guess the idea of the conferences then is that we will generate activity from the participants to go out and wage the fight, because ultimately we've got to change the whole education system. Lynn has talked repeatedly about defeating science based on sense perception, or the idea that any knowledge is based on sense perception. And to me, I think that's the hardest battle of all, mm-hmm. because, you know, seeing is believing is the way most people think. They just say something like that without thinking about what it means. And I think this is where we have to be especially creative in terms of the kind of educational process that has to be transformed. Again, the education system we have is collapsed. It doesn't work. But that doesn't mean you're going to get something good out of it. I mean, Michael, you've been doing some work on campuses with people in the engineering and NASA and things of that sort. They must have a sense of the failure of the education system to do this.
Oh, they certainly do. And they have a sense of a decreasing caliber of people coming in who have a sense of why they're there and what they intend to accomplish with the education that might be available. I think that what's interesting is what kind of transformation and economic development that we've laid out, the NWAPA, the water developments in Africa, the questions of nuclear power, the Bering Strait rail systems. Though these will immediately accommodate basic things like jobs, water, power, the additional benefits are sometimes just not regarded, which is a complete development of an entire generation through a sense of optimism, through a sense of mission. I mean, I think an interesting polemic is, you know, the sun's not going to last forever. Maybe we have a billion years, maybe we have half a billion years left. We've got to inspire the generation. The only way you can educate is to inspire a generation or inspire young people with a kind of mission orientation that might be the development of, you know, basic aspects of society, the basic infrastructure. But really, how do you inspire genius? How do you inspire the new Beethovens and Mozarts? And I think Mikulak can testify to this. It isn't simply to address the crisis, but it's to set a new stage for what mankind must do. How do we move off this earth and sustain the human species? I think it's interesting that provokes the true quality of the human mind, a completely very much an unpractical but very real question. So I think that's crucial to an education process today. We've got to recruit these professors and these engineers and these teachers to realize that it isn't going to be through tweeting or through Facebook that you re-engage a generation in these kinds of profound questions. And into science,
Michael,
and music, and development, you're going to have to actually become much more bold, much more profound, and philosophical. Really go with ideas, and I think that's really the heart and soul of these conferences.
And you have a sense that even though many of these people have been reduced in their teaching loads or their research loads, they've been beaten down by peer review and so on, that if the lid were taken off, they would. There's a hunger for truth. You have a sense of that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what was presented in the New York conference, that if you take children, I mean, when this restoration of classical culture, this grouping called into these New York City schools, the principals, the teachers thought, nah, no one's going to be really interested. No one really wants to do that. These students, maybe a Jay-Z concert, maybe Beyonce lip singing could get them excited, but, you know, Bach, Mozart, no, they don't want to go. Then they went and asked some teachers, and there was some excitement. The teachers asked some students, there was more excitement. And when the students came, I think it was an anecdote that a New York Times writer came to cover the concert in a way which was, you know, they're trying to introduce these kids to classical music. The kids have... They haven't had the development, they haven't had the training, they haven't had the education, this isn't going to work. And they were stunned. It worked far better than anyone had imagined to engage people, a concentrated audience, I mean, dead silence. People just cherish the moment to hear something like that. And that's a testament.
Well, that's what we need, because the dead silence, for the most part, is people scratching their head saying, how did we end up with such idiots making policy for us? And so to come back to it, we had this conference last Saturday. Since that time, Mihua, you've been involved in some work on this. I assume besides, well, let me just say again, people should watch this week's weekly report. You're doing it again this week?
Yes, as of now.
Okay, so that's Wednesday afternoon. It will be up on the website archive. The weekly report will include some of the discussion or the takeoff from the discussion we've had today. So as far as national projects, are there going to be some specific pieces we'll be taking up, the way the German organization took up the Ode to Joy, the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven? Are we ready for something like that in the U.S.?
Oh, sure. We are emotionally ready. So in light of that, we're continuing with the Bach. We're reviving a piece that we started the entire under 50 organization with, Jesu meine Freude by Bach, one of his motets. And that's going to be, both of those are actually going to be performed at this March conference. And it's a beautiful, pair to have, in terms of ideas, the Magnificat and also the Jesu meine Freude. Now, throughout the West Coast, we've taken on, parts of Bach's Mass in B minor.
Whoa.
For our conference in May, and that's going to include everybody on the West Coast. And I think it's interesting from Bach's standpoint as a Lutheran to write an entire Catholic Mass. So you realize it was a spiritual endeavor, and I think the point that Michael brought up just now on the question of inspiration, I mean, that's the real key. You can't go out there and tell people what to do. We're at our tables. We're not sitting there with a list of bullet points and say, this is what you need to do. You need to do this and that. But we're intending to inspire people, because that's really the only way you can get them to move, because they are their own, you know, individuals. And how do you create a momentum within them that gets them to want to do something? And the role of the classical culture in the music, our role as performers, is it's a responsibility that goes beyond just giving something to somebody, but inspiring, putting it in the context of all of society, not just art, but putting people in the standpoint of what they're going to be doing with their own lives.
Well, that's a great note to end on, because you know, we have a lot of people who listen to this program and who participate on the LaRouche PAC website and conference calls, and then they go out to organize, and they think that the organizing is you just have to pound on someone's head until they open their eyes, that we have to support Glass-Steagall, we have to have a credit policy, we have to have NWAPA. And what you find out is that this is it's not an iterative process. It's that you get someone to move when they're inspired by the idea that they can create a better future, and that their life has meaning beyond how much food they can eat, how many sexual experiences they can have, how many winning bets on the Super Bowl they can make, but they actually have something that goes beyond that, that their intellectual and spiritual existence is tied to something, a better time for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really important point, and I know that that's something that many people who have become part of the LaRouche movement get frustrated, because you get, you know, you guys both experience it. Someone says they're going to do something, and you talk to them, you organize them, and then you actually think they're going to do something, but as soon as they hang up, you're pretty sure they're not going to. And that it's really not just a question that they're accustomed to being apathetic or lying, both of which are true, but that they haven't been moved to the point of seeing themselves differently.
Mm-hmm.
We have about a minute and a half to go. Michael, did you have anything you wanted to add at the end?
No, I think that most of all, I guess one quick short thing is, people, we should fight for victory. This is a point now where we can win and lose the development of human civilization, and people should look into themselves, take a look at really use these ideas to consider their own sense of identity, and we should fight for victory. Everything's on the line, and this fight is winnable. So,
and give us the means to fight.
What, Miha?
I said, give us the means to fight.
Yes, and have fun doing it.
Yeah.
All right, well, this has been the LaRouche Show for February 2nd, 2013. Mike and Miha, thanks very much for joining me. I know this was a last-minute thing, and I'm glad both of you were able to make the time for it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Harley.
All right, and we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern for the LaRue Show. In the meantime, we've got to get the Glass-Steagall through, the credit system through, and NOAPA 21. Use the LaRouchePack.com website and use your new powers of creating inspiration in others to get them to join us in this fight. So we'll see you next week on the LaRue Show. Thank you.